HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 167, recorded live Friday, June 19th, 2009. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. And by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott talks convention over configuration with Jeremy Miller.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm here in Norway still, and I'm hanging out with Jeremy Miller, the Shade Tree developer and also the author of Structure Map. Thanks for coming up here and talking to me today.
Thanks for having me.
So we've got a lot of really cool talks here in Norway, and you had a talk on convention over configuration, and I knew we needed to talk about that. So we hear convention over configuration basically everywhere that's not in the .NET space, and we've only recently started hearing about it within the context of ASP.NET MVC, which in fact borrows from a lot of places that aren't in the typical .NET space. .NET developers are used to a lot of angle brackets and config files that go on for days. I know that for a while, Structure Map had a lot of configuration involved, and recently that's changed. So you're getting into this convention thing as well?
Oh, absolutely. And it is definitely a case of Ruby on Rails envy.
Really?
I think it just took us a couple years to realize that we could do it ourselves. It's just that it manifests itself very differently when we do it in .NET development.
Okay, and why is that?
Well, we're statically typed. We can't do a lot of this dynamic property generation with metaprogramming that can in Ruby, but we have all these other tools. We have the typing system. We can take advantage of open generic declarations. There's a lot of rich type metadata we can get at that we're already doing that's creating information about our system that we were then recreating inside of explicit configuration, whether it be in angle bracket hell or just through programmatic configuration. Instead, why not just scan the information that's already in the type system and use that to wire things up?
Okay. Now, is this just when I think of configuration, I think of what assembly type I should load, my connection strings, maybe a directory location for something. You know, what kinds of things that were typically configuration can be replaced with convention?
Well, how pieces wire up. I think the best, the easiest to example to go at is thinking about configuring object relational mapping.
Okay.
Inversion of control is good too. Well, let's talk about ORM mapping.
All right.
3 years ago, when we were using in Hibernate, you might have been using the active record attributes. For us, we were using an XML file. We were specifying a lot of facts. A class maps to a table that probably has the same name, but I still have to say class name and table name. I'm mapping columns. I'm specifying what the primary key of the object is. Even though you can find this information in the database, but I still had to specify it in Hibernate mappings. How the identifier was created. Is it controlled by the database? Is it controlled by classes? That's a lot of explicit stuff that I have to do.
So you're saying something simple like, public class customer is from the customer's table. That was being repeated in some configuration.
Yes.
And there's also the pluralization of that.
Yes, if you want to do the pluralization.
Yeah, I don't know if you do. Is that a religious argument?
I don't know. I don't bother with
it. I remember seeing David Hanemeyer Hansen give a talk about how awesome, Ruby on Rails was and how the pluralization actually had a specific thing in case you had a table called Octopus. And a collection that would be octopi, and he was really proud of that.
I think
you never know when you might have a table called octopus.
I think that's really cool, but I think that's a lot like going back to the VB days when we argued about two spaces or four spaces for indention. But a consistent convention, and we have these conventions in our code all the time, or we just do things a default way. So why not instead let the ORMM mapper infer from the shape of the object, the way the mappings work by default. Okay. And at this point, I should only have to override the things that deviate from this convention.
Okay. So only exceptional cases would get any configuration information at all.
Yes.
Does that mean that in the typical case, in the 80% case, you wouldn't require any configuration at all?
If you're following your standards and your conventions, yes.
Okay. So is this something that is only in Hibernate and ORMs, or is this something that, how would I start applying these to my applications?
Well, so the ORM's a big deal. That's a big deal by itself. In version of control containers, we do the same thing. You mentioned MVC development.
Right.
MVC out of the box, your URLs, you have the application root, and then the next argument is a controller name.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. The controllers, by just a convention or an idiom, we would name them home controller, report controller, something controller. The URL would be report home / something to the action.
Right.
So a lot of us are using inversion of control tools to host the controllers. You just go to the IOC tool and say, give me the controller for this name. So we have that naming convention. Let's just let the controller scan over the types in our assembly and know that home controller is registered as lowercase home. That's a convention. It's a naming convention we can take advantage of. So as I start to add new things to the system, I can add a new controller, code it up, unit test it, but I don't have to worry about telling the container or the MVC that, hey, this new thing exists. It's already there and available and accessible through a URL.
Okay. I'm trying to think what else we could expand this to. I mean, I'm trying to think of other kinds of configuration information that I've got. I know that you could probably take it to really dramatic lengths. Like, I know that I've had configuration for development, for staging, and production. I suppose if I wanted to take convention over configuration to as far as I could even name my systems, my computer names, a certain way.
Well, I mean, that's supposed to be a bad practice, right? Isn't that supposed to make your system easy to hack?
I don't know.
Well, so maybe. Some of the other things I can think of, I know there are people that are experimenting with the creation of UIs.
Mm-hmm.
Like one of the, as we build a lot of these CRUD screens, I mean, we're using text boxes, we're using drop downs. The drop downs have to be filled from somehow. We're probably doing these things very consistently.
True.
Anytime I have a date field that's editable on the screen, I want it to show up with this particular date control.
Mm-hmm.
So something I'm seeing a lot of people experiment with is just simply expressing, I want the input element for this object or this property.
Right.
And the conventions will take over and say, well, look, it's a string field. I'm going to use the text box. But it's also decorated with some kind of validation attribute that says it can only be 100 long. So I'm also going to come back and set the maximum length of the text box. And look, it says that it's a required field. Somehow I can tie into validation and I know it's a required field. So maybe my designers want all required input elements to be colored pale blue.
Mm-hmm.
Or no, what if they want a red asterisk aft? That's the kind of coding that I don't really want to have to spend a lot of time on. I just want it to happen.
Right.
We can set a convention, or really just setting up, not necessarily a convention, but a policy that this is the way it always is.
I like that. The idea, now, convention is one, is a good word, but policy, I think, is a really, all we need to do is get the team of us, whether it be 5 of us or 100 of us, to just agree. And I think that in my experience on developing for the web, CSS people and designers are like the first people to get this convention over configuration right. Just say, if this text box has a class of date, then all these validators happen for free and all this look and feel happens for free and it just works. That can be pushed down farther and farther and farther. Actually, one of the other applications, not just ASP.NET MVC, but ASP.NET Dynamic Data, was another app that no configuration at all, one line to say the database is over there, and everything else was completely conventional. If there was a Boolean type, then you use boolean.ascx. And it's interesting because it freaks .NET developers out, because since 2002, everything has been configurable. Yeah, the location of a file, the name of a file, the extension, all of it has had some angle bracket somewhere buried that could be overridden. And now to tell them that, by the virtue that this thing was named this way, it's just going to work.
Well, you bring up a really good point. It is, the potential problem with it is it's black magic. There's no explicit code that you can look at that's going to tell you exactly what's going to happen. So there's a couple ways you can beat the problem. And the first is kind of a team-wide social contract. these are our conventions. You have to have the entire team understanding and agreeing to follow these conventions. Mm-hmm. That's step number one. Step number two is you probably need to think about some diagnostics. Take the IOC example. Mm-hmm. What's in my container? I make up these conventions, the controller configuration. I use the I something. I something is implemented by something to automatically wire something to I something.
For those listeners that don't speak English, that whole sentence may have been a little bit confusing, but you're saying that by virtue of the fact that I have an I person interface, and I might have a person class, I can glean that just because I'm putting I in front of my interface.
Yeah. So that can be a little bit scary. Now you're letting the program itself infer what it's supposed to do.
Right.
You're going to need to troubleshoot and understand what's my convention coming up with. You can beat that by creating some diagnostics. In our case, like the controller example, let's make sure we have an easy report that can tell us what controllers does the IOC container think it has, mm-hmm. and under what name, as a beginning to troubleshooting.
Okay, so like a check disk for your app to just go and say, all right, well, just let me know all the different possibilities and dump it out and look at it and say, does this look correct?
Exactly.
Okay. You know, there's other things I've seen that this may be a silly example, but it actually was useful to me. I was working at a large company recently as a consultant. I can't say what it is, but let's just say that they were doing cars. And we needed some graphics. And there's all these different car manufacturers out there. And we figured out just by poking around on their website that they had like images.foo.com/, and I could say Ford.png, and I get the Ford logo. And we were doing this demo for the vice president, so it was really just proof of concept code. But we knew that putting some graphics in would kind of, you know, sex it up a little bit. And they said, oh, put the logo for the car company here. And we said, oh, wait a second. They have an image server, right? Let's see what happens if we put in Ford, Chevy, Audi, Fiat. And, oh, look, they've come up with a very basic convention. It was simple, but I was worried, legitimately worried, because I've had this happen before, that I was going to have to go to a database somewhere and get the actual URL for this image. And by virtue of the fact that this company had done this very simple and common sense, although that's the thing about common sense, it's not that common, thing, we were able to just, in a 30 seconds of a little bit of extra coding, put in some graphics that made the demo just a little fractional of a percent easier. So image pass, CSS naming, scripts, all these things can make life a lot easier.
Definitely. And that's a great example of the value of this kind of thing. A lot of these things we're talking about, they're small things, but they're the small things that we do over and over and over again. By making it be less friction, mm-hmm. to make a change or an addition to the system. It makes this easier, of course, to extend the system, but it also makes it easier for us to iterate to the system. And take the example of a user interface. Mm-hmm. You come up with an idea of how you think it should work, you show it to the user, and you find out that you were completely wrong.
Right.
You need to change it. By having less machinery to change those images on those pages, maybe you could iterate faster and take advantage of the feedback that you got and come out with a better product.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman with a word from our sponsor. Do you know how to build Web 2.0 AJAX applications with Web 1.0 components? You really can't. If you want to do the next generation web applications, you'll need next generation components. Just like the ones that our friends at Telerik have got, they're RAD controls for ASP.NET AJAX. It's a huge pack of web controls built on top of ASP.NET AJAX that'll add previously impossible performance and interactivity to your next project. The new controls mirror the AJAX API from ASP.NET, so development is really straightforward. The client scripts are shared, so loading time is not a problem. If you just set a couple of properties, and you'll be able to automatically bind to web services for a really efficient operation. The new RAD editor from ASP.NET AJAX Telerik loads up to 4 times faster than before, and the new RAD grid handles thousands of records in just milliseconds. But as always, it's best to try for yourself. So you can visit Telerik.com/ASP.NET AJAX and download a trial. Thanks a lot.
What are some other examples that you gave in your talk about convention over configuration? And what was the general gist of what you're trying to get across to the attendees?
The general gist, it's a meme I see a lot more often now. The idea of essence versus ceremony. Essence being what your business partners want you to deliver. Mm-hmm. And ceremony being all the hoops, the developer type hoops we have to jump through. type declarations, XML files, configuration, registry settings, stuff that's pure overhead. Mm-hmm. What we're trying to do is to create more essence with less ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
In the talk, I talked about inversion of control, container configuration. Mm-hmm. We talked a lot about sensible defaults.
Sensible defaults.
Sure. So when I'm building a database, an object model that has persisted this database, I can identify things in several different ways. I can create IDs. I can use GUIDs. I could use composite keys. I could use natural keys. But instead, let's say that we start a sensible default that every single entity is simply identified by a numeric ID field.
Okay.
Or a GUID.
Sure.
Now that I say that every single object, every domain entity is created this way, I can start to share policies about the way that it's persisted,
mm-hmm.
Which also allows me to make some assumptions in my infrastructure, assuming that every entity can be treated the same way as far as locating it, saving it, validating it. That enables us to share and reuse a lot of infrastructure between things like CRUD screens,
mm-hmm.
And reporting screens. And it's a great kind of opportunity to shrink down the size of your code base.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at it from another way, something you'll hear a lot from the Ruby guys. They talk about the idea of opinionated software. And this kind of frustrates some people. But it's the idea that we can make things easier by taking away choice from the developers. That the system really expects things to be in a certain way. And if you'll just do them this way, the infrastructure will let it flow easier.
Mm-hmm. So you're going to increase productivity if you can release a little bit of control.
Exactly.
Okay.
Now, the problem and the downside, I know I've heard from the MVC team. The feedback on Rails is that the conventions are baked in and inflexible.
Mm-hmm.
I think the lesson that we've learned from it, and I've seen in projects like Fluid and Hibernate and FUBU MVC, is actually giving you the ability to create your own conventions and policies, mm-hmm. so that a team can customize the naming conventions for their database mappings or how controls are rendered on the screen. So you're not locked into whatever convention I happen to like.
But if we take this idea forward 5 years, 10 years, where every piece of software is opinionated software, does that mean that there's even more syntax and more obscurity to the point where every single framework is its own little DSL that I'm going to have to understand? Because I've written Rails code, and I'm finding it, I always have found it difficult to be an expert, because to be an expert is also to be an expert in trivia. Maybe trivia is not the right word, but in the tricks. Is that really the case in every system?
Well, it's a definite, what you described is a definite downside to the technique, but so taking the example of all these DSLs, these little languages I have to learn.
DSLs are domain-specific languages for the listeners.
Yeah, I think that concern is a little bit of a red herring.
Okay.
Because every time I pick up a framework or a new tool, I have to learn a completely new kind of API, which even though it's in C# or VB.net, it may be speaking Greek. Okay? The DSL idea is an attempt at creating a better API, an API that allows you to express the essence of what you're trying to do without jumping through quite so many XML angle bracket hoops to get there. Whether you succeed or not in that DSL depends on a lot of factors, but that's the definite goal.
I know that you've been experimenting a lot lately, taking what would have been, 10, 20, 30 lines of angle brackets inside of an XML file and turning it into what they're calling a fluent interface, which almost is an English sentence, which is, methods and objects strung together all into one long kind of line. And you've done this recently, I think, with both StructureMap, and you've been using Fluent and Hibernate. Is that right?
Both Fluent and Hibernate and StructureMap. Maybe a quick example I can give you. Or I should say, the purpose of what I'm trying to do is to gather things that today may be a lot of related pieces, but they're spread out over either the code base, big XML files. And I'm trying to compress that content and the declaration of intent in a smaller area, mm-hmm. reducing the surface area. Take the example in WPF of creating keyboard shortcuts.
Right.
You have a XAML node somewhere that defines a bunch of commands. And you give the command a key name. It's pointed to a class. Who knows where it's at? At another place, maybe in the same XAML file, maybe not, you're creating an entirely different set of XAML nodes to define that a keystroke, control one, control two, calls this command by name.
Right, it's all very kind of normalized.
Yeah, it's data-centric programming. Mm-hmm. We're coding directly to the low levels of WPF. Instead, coming up with a very small Fluent interface where I can say, these keys call this command and just pass in the command type in a generic.
Mm-hmm.
Behind the scenes, it's going to a container and getting the object model. It's doing a lot of stuff behind the scenes. It's creating the same input binding command object, all the stuff that was happening in the XAML before.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is you have a small place in the code where you can see what all of these things are and see how they connect directly to one another.
Mm-hmm.
Taking it farther, this small expression, I can be a keyboard shortcut, I can have it show up in a dynamically created menu, and maybe even a button bar across the top, but expressed one place in one small area of the code.
Is this something that exists now, or is this a theory that you've come up with?
This is in the Storyteller code base.
Oh, really? So in the Storyteller code base that I can poke around in Subversion right now?
That will be checked in by the time you, dear listeners, receive this podcast.
Very cool. So that's cool, because I actually did a podcast earlier with Ian Griffith about WPF, and we were talking about stuff. So now I've got a little thing there that I can use. But talk to me about what a Fluent interface would look like. I know that we're doing this in audio, so people can't see the code, but this really is almost a sentence. Maybe
yes.
Explain like a structure map example, like one line of code, and walk me through what a typical Fluent structure map conventional thing would look
sure.
like, and what that would really expand out to if I had to do it in XML.
So, actually, can I start from the XML first?
Okay, whatever makes you happy.
So, Scott inferred earlier that the XML configuration of structure map early on was terrible. Except he said it politely.
I said it politely.
It was terrible.
Okay.
You would have to express that it's okay to pull types from this assembly. So there's a node that says assembly, this name. Then I would say, I have a plugin family of classes that plug into this interface. There's another XML node. Then I might say, this concrete class can be plugged into this interface.
At this point, you've already lost me.
Yeah.
And we're four or five deep into an arrow-shaped XML file.
Okay.
Right?
Now that you're horrified, we'll move on to the FI approach. Today, to do that same kind of thing, in the trunk of Storyteller,
I would say... You said the FI approach, the Fluent interface.
I'm sorry, Fluent interface. So in the Fluent interface approach, I would simply say, if I have an iFoo interface, and it has one class that I want to be plugged in as the default iFoo, that's Foo, classic Foo example.
Okay.
I would say for, and use generic angle brackets.
So the word for.
For, angle brackets, iFoo.
Okay.
Close your print, open and close parentheses, dot, use, angle brackets, foo.
For iFoo, use foo.
Yes.
And instead of spaces in your English there, you're using angle brackets and parentheses. But
yes.
For all intents, it's an English sentence. It's a declaration.
It's yes.
It's the classic Martin Fowler described Fluent interface.
Yes. Now, do be careful. We have experimented, and I was guilty with this, trying too hard to make it look like a sentence so that it reads, for requested type, iFoo, the default dot is dot of concrete
See, now that's
type.
It's interesting that you say that because talking about being polite versus being real, some of the initial examples that I'd seen in your blog when you were just kind of exploring that and others who have made similar interfaces, when I see, you know, for dot is dot, you know, dot, I'm like, okay, come on. Is? Really? You have an is object?
It's an is expression interface.
But you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. We tried this experiment first. I would say that we have some internal DSLs that I can show to my product manager, and he can actually say, yeah, that's right, that's wrong.
You're non-technical, non-programmer.
Non-technical
manager.
People.
Okay.
But we're developers. We can read code. Instead, I've found really adopting it from jQuery. jQuery-style
really?
Code, going for a much more terse infrastructure. And that means I'm ditching the for and with and the ands and
right.
trying to make it as tight as possible. So far, I think I'm liking that approach. But it may be just because we use so much jQuery now.
That is really interesting. That's a bit of a tangent, but the idea that the looking at jQuery and the way that jQuery expresses itself is just somehow, not really quantifiably, but clearly, such a comfortable to write thing that we would look to the JavaScript library that we use a lot and apply that to code that we're writing somewhere else in C#.
Terse is good.
And it's interesting. Because that's funny, because jQuery still has that magic language, the selector language inside of its string, where, you know, part of it's fluent until you get into a string and then you pass stuff in. When you're creating a fluent interface for StructureMap, have you found times when you, rather than trying to string objects together, you really just end up with some tiny DSL in a string, or have you not got that far yet?
That's something to think about. I would say I have not done any kind of interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
There are some places, I do that a lot for setting up test data.
Yeah.
There are other tricks besides method chaining, in which you can find all of this. On Martin Fowler's website, there is a book, there's a section called the DSL Work in Progress, and he talks a lot about different design patterns for creating internal domain-specific languages.
And this is the book that Martin has been writing for going on 3 years now, and he's been doing it in progress. He's basically writing this book and putting that up, his notes, really,
yes,
as he writes it, and you can watch yes. him write the book.
But the point is, there are other tricks, very useful tricks, besides method chaining. Method chaining gets kind of nasty to implement when you get past a few things.
Mm-hmm.
You can use object initializers. Much like the way the Ruby guys kind of idiomatically pass around dictionaries as
right.
a way to kind of create more readable code.
Do you think that this is a little bit of a tangent, but do you think that C# 4 and the dynamic and the dynamic keyword and the ability to not use IntelliSense and instead figure out a method at runtime would make a fluent interface easier to write?
Maybe easier to read and consume.
Probably not easier to write since you wouldn't have IntelliSense.
But that's the point to me. This is a tangent, but at that point, I think you just need to reach for Iron Ruby or Iron Python.
Really? Rather than using C# kind of attempt at dynamism?
Yes. Dynamicness? Ruby, if you're trying to create a DSL, an internal DSL, Ruby is going to be far more readable because
that'll
there's
be
less
really interesting.
Stuff in the code.
So as somebody who writes C# for a living, myself and yourself, it'll be interesting to see if we start doing convention over configuration and fluent interfaces and DSLs to drive our C# applications if Ruby, Iron Ruby in this case, becomes the de facto way to do it. I know that Oren, Allende uses Boo
yeah.
as his kind of primary DSL, and he's been pushing it for years. Has that caught on beyond just Oren himself?
Maybe not so much in the .NET camp. I think it's much more common maybe in the Java camp where they've had alternative languages longer than us.
Right.
So the same kind of things we see the Java guys doing have maybe the hardcore domain and anything that's performance intensive or infrastructure being in Java and the business rules and the glue code moving up into more dynamic languages like Groovy
right.
or JRuby, where there's much more terse syntax and you can create more readable code.
Mm-hmm.
We may be doing the same kind of things.
You and I were having an interesting discussion earlier about doing acceptance testing, and you had mentioned a tool that a lot of Ruby guys use called Cucumber. And I had seen we talked about fit and fitness, and Uncle Bob Martin is here at the talk trying to figure out how to do this. And a guy had given – one of my old bosses actually had given me a demo of Cucumber, and he showed how he could write what looked like English. And that was the convention that he passed on to the suits that lived in his company. And then he showed me the other side, which were the tests. And then after he'd showed me kind of the wonderful English he'd written and that his suits worked on and the wonderful tests he'd written, and I was like, wow, this is amazing. Wait a second. How does this fit together? And then he like, well, here, let me open this text file full of regular expressions.
Yeah.
And then suddenly things stopped being so magical and started being kind of disgusting. And he's like, well, yeah, we really haven't got an answer for that. This file uses regular expressions to read English and map it to these tests right here. Do convention over configuration systems necessarily have to have something disgusting in the middle, or is it just really can it be very, very basic, like the example I'd said of if you name your GIFs this way, it'll just work, or if you name your interfaces that way, it'll just work? How often is there black magic, like, buried somewhere that we don't want to talk about, I guess is my question.
Well, I think it's all black magic.
Really?
It may be simpler tricks.
Not necessarily
tricks.
Regular expressions.
If you're going to build this yourself, or I think for you to understand how these are usually implemented,
mm-hmm.
there's usually something the Fowler calls the semantic model directly underneath. Say we're working on Fluent in Hibernate, and we're building our own conventions. Say, for us, we have a convention that determines the many-to-many table mapping names.
Okay.
We have many-to-many relationships.
Right.
It's very important. You always want the names the exact same way. Under the hood, it's altering a property on a many-to-many table map property. There's actually a class. You are...
Can you give me a concrete example?
It's called the many-to-many table map, I believe.
Oh, all right. Okay.
But say our convention is you take... If you're relating one class to another class,
okay.
You take the two class names, you make sure that you put it in alphabetical order so that the name would be identical going from A to B or B to A.
Okay.
And that first name to second name is how we determine our many-to-many table mapping.
Hmm.
That's setting a property of a class inside of Fluent in Hibernate. And at the very last minute, this semantic model, this whole object graph of how things are mapped from class to table, property to the column name, that at the last minute is used to configure in Hibernate itself internally. Mm-hmm. If you ever decide to build one of these things yourself, you build a semantic model that actually performs the runtime activity. You test that very well. You layer conventions or a DSL on top of the semantic model. Your conventions are altering this runtime object graph, or your DSL is writing to the semantic model.
Okay, this might be a stretch, but because I'm doing multiple podcasts in a day here, I'm starting to attach things that I've talked to in previous shows. We talked to Ian about why I was running into problems with my application. I had my view, and I thought I had a view model, but it was really just a bunch of sloppy code that was talking to my view. I needed multiple layers, and I really just had one big ball of a mess. I didn't really have a view model. You're describing the semantic model. When you're saying semantic model, I started thinking about view models versus models. You're saying to really have that layer, that is that object graph that shows your intent effectively, and separating that out from where that intent was sourced from, where it came from. It came out of configuration, or it came out of a Fluent model, or it came out of convention.
Yes.
It's just interesting that, you know, all problems in computer science can be solved by one additional layer of abstraction, whether it be adding a view model to a previously cluttered view or adding a semantic model to your semantics.
So that's absolutely true. If you want to think of it this way, the semantic model, you can build any way that's easiest for you to make it work. In WPF, we don't really have much of a separation. What you see in XAML is pretty well a serialized copy of the raw semantic model,
mm-hmm.
the controls, the tree. The DSL or conventions, it's just putting icing on the cake, or if you have to say it, it's lipstick on the pig. It's trying to create an API that's friendly for the user, where I can be very concerned about what's best for the user, that just simply helps configure the things that work. It's isolating the user from the mechanics so that I can build the mechanics in a way that's easy for me as a developer and still provide a good experience for the developers using it.
And that might be the essence of why this isn't obvious to the average Joe, is using either, whether it be WPF as the example or using a system in C#, is that there's nothing in the tooling, there's nothing in the language that enforces this. There's nothing in WPF when I go file a new WPF application that forces me to have a view model. And, you know, there's even now in Fluent and Hibernate and in StructureMap, I'm sure I could probably shoot myself in the foot if I wasn't using these Fluent interfaces correctly, right? I mean, they don't prevent me from expressing myself incorrectly.
That's absolutely right. If I do my job well as an API designer,
mm-hmm.
and things are consistent and I fail fast, I have to try to detect when you do something wrong and fail fast and tell you where and why you did something wrong. And I have to be consistent all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
That was a part of another one of my talks. I did a lessons learned talk from StructureMap development. And I outlined where I've gotten in trouble in my StructureMap API from mm-hmm. inconsistencies or making a developer do what seems like the exact same task. In StructureMap configuring, when you try to override constructor arguments explicitly, you do strings and numbers and primitive types one way,
mm-hmm.
but for dependencies, non-primitive types, you do it another way. And that confuses structure map users. It's something I'm getting trouble with right now. I know as the developer of this tool that structure map handles primitives and non-primitives differently. Mm-hmm. So I made the API reflect that. But the user shouldn't have to know that. I should make the API
you
smart
ask too much
enough.
Of them.
Exactly. That's the kind of mistake you can make with these ESL APIs.
Okay. Interesting. Well, cool. Well, thank you so much for sitting down with me today and explaining this stuff to me. And I suppose that people are going to be able to see your talk online at some point. So I'll put links up to the NDC, the Norwegian Developers Conference talk, as well as your blog. And then you're also on Twitter.
Yes.
All right. Well, this has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, this week talking with Jeremy Miller. And I'll see you again next week.